KQED.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, committed to improving California's healthcare delivery and financing systems, on the web at chcf.org. The James Irvine Foundation, sponsoring the James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards, with information online at www.irvine.org. And TIAA CREF, serving those who serve others by offering financial services for the greater good. TIAA-CREF.org.
From KQED Public Radio, this is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. On today's show, what's in a name? High stakes in a controversy over who controls the names of internet addresses. And a new San Francisco museum preaches racial harmony.
All living people long ago came from one spot. And no matter where you go to have your DNA checked, it leads you back to Africa.
Also, mellow cross-country skiing gets a kick in the pants, and a high school marching band that's inspiring kids in the Central Valley.
Music is one of the best ways to express how you feel. You can give your own personality through playing instruments, and it's just my way of being happy.
It's the California Report. Chances are you've never heard of an obscure group called the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, ICANN for short, but if you surf the web, you've benefited from its accomplishments. ICANN is the international body that coordinates the .coms, .nets, and all the other web addresses on the Internet. But ICANN leaders meeting at a summit in Vancouver this past week found themselves embroiled in a controversy that some worry will stifle innovation and creativity on the web. San Jose Bureau Chief Peter John Schuler reports.
Despite a variety of web address domain names currently available, .com remains the most popular and the most coveted. A Mountain View company called VeriSign administers all .com web addresses and the nearly as popular .net. Every time someone registers a .com or .net web address, VeriSign collects a fee. But in two separate lawsuits filed in San Jose federal court this past Monday, two industry groups accused VeriSign and ICANN of price-fixing and other anti-competitive behavior. Ron Jackson publishes the Domain Name Journal and is a board member of one of the groups that launched the complaint. He wants to block what he calls a sweetheart deal between VeriSign and ICANN.
Essentially, it gives VeriSign control of the .com registry permanently. It would never likely be put up for bid again. So you just, you know, monopolies are never good in business. No one benefits from that other than the monopoly holder.
Although web surfers aren't likely to notice any immediate change, the dispute could have far-reaching implications on how web addresses are managed. Jackson claims the agreement would allow VeriSign to increase its .com registration fees by 7% every year, costing consumers an estimated $1.5 billion over 7 years. VeriSign did not return repeated phone calls, but in published reports has called the $1.5 billion figure nutty. In a teleconference from Vancouver, ICANN officials defended the proposed deal with VeriSign. CEO Paul Toomey says it would promote stability and security in the domain name system. And he says there are a number of protections in place to prevent price gouging.
Prices have to be equal across to all registrants. So it does not allow VeriSign to try to charge $1 million a name for a series of names. And it has to be the same for all new registrations. That's a further, and if you actually look at the churn rate inside .com, you'll understand that actually is a very important issue.
For their part, small business owners say modest price hikes to renew their website addresses don't have them too worried. At Griffin Stringed Instruments in Palo Alto, owner Richard Johnston points to other costs, such as Yellow Page listings, and says his website remains a tiny fraction of his marketing budget. But he does worry about the overall impact on the vibrancy of the web.
What bothers me is that it will potentially make it a lot harder for, you know, young people or low-income people or just the general Joe who wants to put up a website about something esoteric and potentially weird that doesn't really have any commercial value. And so currently, if you want to put your grandmother's kimono collection on a website and let a lot of people enjoy it, it's great, and you don't have to sell anything to have it be worthwhile. It's just a few dollars a year. And I would hate to see that go away.
Derek Cullimore works at Griffin and is also a musician. He says his website is his most important tool for getting bookings and selling his CDs. And he says he doesn't know what he'd do if the price to maintain it started going up.
It's scary to think that I could lose that, because it'd be losing a big part of what I do, and feel it would set me back a few years in promotions and things of that nature.
ICANN has extended the period for public comment on the proposed deal, which must be approved by the organization's board of directors. A court hearing on the domain name dispute is set for February. For the California Report, I'm Peter John Schuler in San Jose.
At a recent community preview of San Francisco's new Museum of the African Diaspora, the message was this: despite our differences, all humanity is really one big family with roots in Africa. Museum curators have a lofty idea that exploring our common ties might help us become a more harmonious global family. Andrea Kissick has more.
Webster's Dictionary defines diaspora as the scattering of a people from their homeland. In this case, people from Africa who migrated to Europe, Asia, and the Americas, by and large through the slave trade. The theme of San Francisco's newest museum is to show how Africa has influenced us all. Belva Davis is president of the board of directors of the museum.
All living people long ago came from one spot. And no matter where you go to have your DNA checked, you will find, if you really look at it, that it leads you back to Africa.
The idea for the museum started 10 years ago when community organizers got together to explore building an African-American cultural center in San Francisco. But Davis says after much disagreement, the mission changed when organizers decided what the world needs right now is a museum focused on our global commonalities.
How do we as African Americans show leadership toward a movement toward world harmony? How do we approach the whole barriers of race without using the word race? And so the thing was then to look at those things that we shared.
Africa has not only influenced what kinds of food we eat, the clothes we wear, and how we celebrate, but also what kind of music we listen to. At the museum, multimedia installations play the music of the African diaspora. San Francisco's new Museum of the African Diaspora is for the most part upbeat in its exploration of our common ties. It even includes an exhibit of celebrations from all around the world. But the museum also explores the dark side of humanity, explains Executive Director Denise Bradley.
We thought it was important to balance out the sort of celebration circle with the experience that, you know, not all of life has been sort of a bed of roses for people of African descent.
In the exhibit Slavery Passages, visitors enter a darkened room and sit uncomfortably, facing each other on benches, and listen to the stories of slaves.
It was just the same as we was in jail. I couldn't go from here across the street and no more than a dog to some of them in them days. You wasn't treated as good as they treat dogs now.
Telling the story of 2 million years of humanity is ambitious for a museum with so little space. It has just 20,000 square feet inside the new St. Regis high-rise hotel in downtown San Francisco. The museum relied on help from former Mayor Willie Brown, private donors, and the city's redevelopment agency. Although it's not meant to be a collector's museum, it does have gallery space, which features contemporary work by artists of African descent. Pointing to an English bonnet covered in an African print, one of the museum's curators, Sherry Dyson, says the piece is a good example of art from the black diaspora.
What a lot of people don't realize is that this African print fabric is actually made in Holland. It's a Dutch wax method, and it's imported to Africa, and then Africa exports it to us. So in terms of fusion and mixed cultures and what we think is one thing, but it's really something else, I really feel like this piece represents it.
Not all visitors were so certain that the museum's multicultural approach is what the African-American community needs. Linda Perkins is from Los Angeles.
Is it really about us, or is it about making other people feel included? So it's like, for us, we always have to be so inclusive. But other people never feel the need to do that. They can just tell their story.
San Franciscan Frances Terry says she's ready for a museum that pulls people together.
If we don't hurry up and learn how to be connected, we're going to destroy everything that God created. And that man didn't put us here for that.
The Museum of the African Diaspora officially opens this Saturday in San Francisco. For the California Report, I'm Andrea Kissick.
In the tiny farming town of Reedley, in the center of the San Joaquin Valley, thousands of residents gathered Thursday night for an unusual display of town pride, the annual Electric Farm Equipment Parade. Farmers decorated their backhoes and tractors with glittering Christmas lights and competed for the grand prize, the honor of carrying Santa on their tractor in next year's parade.
This is Gard Tutillian Incorporated, one of our sponsors this year. They have been delivering your ag chemicals throughout the San Joaquin Valley. They have over 15,000 lights on this FL-70 truck and trailer.
Wow, that's a lot of lights.
But the glowing trucks weren't the only attraction at this week's parade. The 320 members of the Reedley High School Marching Band also wound Christmas lights around their tubas and saxophones. As Sasha Coker reports, the band is gaining notice across the state, and it's also providing an anchor for teens in this largely low-income rural town.
Marching and Dancing Pirate Band is also known as the Big Green Marching Machine. 17-year-old flautist Sandra Hull explains.
We lovingly call our uniforms pickle outfits. Our school colors are green and black, and we have white shoes, black pants. Oh, and our hats are green with a huge puffy, we call them chicken feathers, at the top. So we're chicken pickles.
Sandra is third generation in this band. Now her father heads up the band boosters, ladling out hot chocolate at the Christmas parade.
Yep. Okay, so you want hot chocolate? Is that right? Okay, all right. That's a dollar. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for supporting the band boosters.
Parents are key to the success of this band. They straighten hats, shine shoes, and sew on buttons. They also raise money, about $25,000 a year, to send the band to performances that have included Disneyland and the Rose Parade. And the local school district is committed to funding music at a time when most schools are drastically cutting arts programs. At Reedley High, one out of every five students is in the band. Most students in this district are low-income and Latino, and many are children of farm workers. When a state budget crisis forced the district to shave $2.5 million from its programs, administrators placed a moratorium on buying new equipment and cars. But music was spared. Irvin Isaac is assistant superintendent for the Kings Canyon Unified School District.
Students in band will attend school. they won't have the attendance problem. So we have a benefit there. We have the students wanting to come to school. And when they're in school, they do better in school academically.
Kids here start taking music classes early. Every sixth grader must take some kind of music class 5 days a week, and most opt for band. By the time they reach high school, kids know how to read music, memorize songs, and play in a group. Another reason the program works is that band directors follow the students from junior high to the high school. Seventeen-year-old Ricardo Olguin says that mentorship from the band instructors helped him find a niche at Reedley High. He wears a black wool hat pulled low over his forehead and spends most of his free time on his skateboard. But standing on the edge of the football field during band practice, he says it's his clarinet that allows him to best channel his emotions.
Music is one of the best ways to express how you feel, and you can give your own personality through playing instruments, and that it's just my way of like being happy or releasing anger. Like, you can always turn to this and just open a music book and play.
But Ricardo didn't always have that outlet. In junior high, he was expelled for bringing a knife to school. His grades slipped, and other kids shunned him as an outsider. Music gave him something to hold on to, says his mother, Armita Redondo.
He had something to focus on besides his studying, because at one point he didn't even care about his studying. I was very, very proud of Ricardo. From hitting rock bottom and then picking up, you know.
Today, Ricardo is a crew chief in the band. He's responsible for teaching 15 other clarinetists where to stand and how to march. Ricardo's grades are back up, too. In fact, the average GPA of most band members is higher than the rest of the school. And every single senior in band has passed the high school exit exam. That's because band members get individual attention and support, says band director Gary Willems.
We have 300 ones, 300 single students. Each student is important to me. We will talk to the kids not as discipline them as much as you're letting me down, you're letting yourself down, and you're letting your team members down if you are not succeeding in this class.
It's bell time! Head up, shoulders back! Act like you know what you're doing! Fool the crowd! Head up, shoulders back! You can do this! Spacing, spacing! Check your spacing!
Willem stands perched at the top of a tall ladder, wearing a green blazer and a Mickey Mouse tie. He uses a megaphone to bark commands at the students on the football field as they practice their signature kick-step dance move. This sea of over 300 kids and their instruments all have to know where to step and hit the right notes. The Reedley High Band holds as much weight here as the football team. And you don't have to be a geek to be a part of it, says trumpeter Carla Reyes.
A lot of people say, hey, band nerd, or, you know, everything's cool here. Like, you're in band, and, like, it makes you cool to be in band here, you know, because it's so big and everyone likes it.
It's that kind of spirit that makes the Big Green Marching Machine an unstoppable success. For the California Report, I'm Sasha Coca in Reedley.
You're listening to the California Report. When you think about thrilling winter activities, downhill skiing and snowboarding may come to mind, but cross-country skiing? Probably not. Too mellow, right? Well, not anymore. There's a hip new twist on it called Nordic jibbing, and it looks a lot like snowboarding. 29-year-old Tor Brown is cross-country ski manager at North Star at Tahoe. He's been jibbing for 3 years. He's even invented a new jib skate that will hit the market this month. He describes the sport this way.
It looks a lot like the alpine jibbing. We're hitting the big tabletop jumps and sliding across the large rails and boxes sideways and coming into them backwards or landing backwards.
Now, snowboarding and alpine skiing can be a little bit risky. Are there ways in which Nordic jibbing are even more risky than those?
I wouldn't say they're more risky, but yeah, it is riskier in that the equipment is lighter weight, so you know you have more potential for crashing. On the other hand, in a lot of ways, there's a lot less risk because the equipment is far more forgiving, and chances are that the equipment may break before you get injured. And because you have a free heel, a lot of times in a crash, because you have that freedom of movement with the foot, you basically release and absorb your crash, and so actually get less injured.
Now, Nordic skis are skinnier, aren't they, than alpine skis, and wouldn't that make it tougher to land without falling down?
Yes, it does. Yeah, it's part of the fun of the challenge of being on the Nordic skis is because they're quite a bit narrower. You have to land in a very balanced stance in order to ride out your landing.
You've been hurt doing this?
A little bit, not too badly. I've sprained a thumb and I've broken a toe. But that's about it. In the last couple of years, with a lot of the events I've been to, the worst we've seen is a broken wrist.
Is there any particular reason that this is developed in California?
Absolutely. I think it's just part of the California lifestyle. I would say the freestyle aspect to many sports is very accepted, and it's something that is maybe looked down on a little bit by traditionalists, especially in the cross-country realm, people from Midwest and back east. And here in California, with freestyle movements coming from surfing and especially skateboarding, it's just accepted that California is often the place these ideas grow from because they are accepted as part of the culture here.
So as this sport continues to grow, are we going to see equipment that's especially made for Nordic jibbing?
Absolutely. Well, the first item is the ski itself, and that hits the market here in a couple weeks. It's being produced by Fisher Skis, and it's called the Jib Skate, and it's got a twin tip to it, and it's been reinforced to withstand landings and so forth. As it grows, hopefully there'll be an evolution in the rest of it, the bindings and the boots as well.
All right, well, Tor Brown, thanks for telling us about Nordic jibbing, and hope you get some snow this weekend.
I hope so, too.
Tor Brown, cross-country ski manager at North Star at Tahoe, describing Nordic jibbing. And finally today, in another case of less is more, an adventurous San Francisco rock band has made an artistic breakthrough by simplifying its ambitious sound. Music critic Steve Hockman gives a listen.
The line between pop and art has been blurry since before Andy Warhol even thought of painting a soup can. Yet that line remains in place, daring each new generation to try to erase it. For a decade or so, San Francisco band Deerhoof has jumped back and forth over the divide, alternately drawing on conventional pop charms and taking them apart. On its seventh album, The Runners Four, the quartet acts as if there's no line at all. Okay, with a song like this one, curiously titled O'Malley, Former Underdog, we certainly don't mean pop as in Hilary Duff, but we also don't mean art as in John Cage. In both aspects, this is boiled down to the basics of ready appeal and arresting invention. It manages to be comfortingly familiar and entirely new all at once. And it's done with the simplest of tools, mostly just John Dietrich's guitar, Chris Cohen's bass, Greg Sonnier's drums, and Satomi Matsuzaki's baby doll voice. Nothing more than, say, Buddy Holly had available back when. They approach it with a similar sense of joyful innocence and exuberance of creation, though the sketched miniatures and disjointed ditties are still a bit skewed. The simplicity on the Runners 4 is something of a new turn, as previous Deerhoof albums saw the band members switching among numerous instruments, leaning more to biting dissonance in their most non-pop moments. By stripping it all down, though, they've hit on something only hinted at before. Nowhere is that more clear than on Twin Killers, with Matsuzaki's airy singing, somewhere between Yoko Ono and Bjork, bouncing off of Cohen's bass lines, that fat Hofner sound unmistakably like vintage Paul McCartney. There are a few bands out there with similar sensibilities, notably New York-based trio Blonde Redhead. And there's even enough of a community around Deerhoof, albeit still very underground, to produce a new tribute album which is available as free downloads through the band's website. It's not mainstream by any stretch, but it's a start. Now, with the giddy bounce of songs like Scream Team, recalling early Talking Heads, Deerhoof's own performances have earned a listen from pop fans not afraid of art, and art snobs not afraid of pop.
Steve Hockman writes the Popeye column for the LA Times. He reviewed The Runners 4 by Deerhoof. And that's the California Report for this week, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. Seal Muller is the technical producer. We had additional engineering from Danny Bringer, Howard Gelman, and Tom Krimkowski. Our interns are John Kane, Kasia Newman, and Allison Johnson. Stacey Bond and Erica Kelly produced the show this week. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. Susan Kennedy is our managing editor. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by Charitable Auto Resources, a full-service vehicle donation program management firm, which helps nonprofit organizations increase their revenue. Online at charitableautoresources.com. TIAA CREF, serving those who serve others by offering financial services for the greater good. TIAA-CREF.org, and the Stewart Foundation for coverage of important issues in public education.